Labor and Consumer Affairs Committee to order, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 3257. And Janet, get us up to speed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3257 is at the request of the Oregon Courts Group. If you recall, the original bill would have allowed a past or present port commissioner or port employee or an agricultural business representative to be one of the public members on the Board of Maritime Pilots. Again, the Board of Maritime Pilots is a nine-member board appointed by the governor. It has three public members currently, three pilot members, and three members that represent commercial shipping interests. The dash two amendments at your place today replace the original bill and provide that the governor may appoint a past or present employee or commissioner of a port to serve on the board in lieu of one of the operators of a commercial ocean-going vessel, so in lieu of one of the industry members, not one of the public members. And it doesn't say anything additional about an agricultural member. Mr. Chair, there's representatives from the pilot groups, the ports, and the shippers here if you need any information from them.
Thank you, Janet. Nod of the head would suffice. have Pat Egan from Port of Portland nodding yes, Dave Fiskum nodding yes, and Ken Armtog nodding yes. Everyone out there is agreeing. So. Rob Douglas is nodding yes also. So, committee, I'd entertain a motion to adopt the dash two amendments. Representative Escalon.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we amend number two amendment into 3258.
Representative Escalon.
57, I'm sorry.
57, yeah. Representative Escalon moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 3257. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Adopted. Representative Escalon.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move 3257 as amended to the House floor. Let's see how it goes to with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Escalon moves House Bill 3257 to the House floor as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any Representative Hovley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify that someone engaged in agricultural business can still remain appointed as a public member. Is that correct?
No. Dash 2s will be a member of a port as a member of the shipper group. And it... Right? Janet, I've got that right.
Yes. There's no specific language that will be in the statute regarding agricultural members.
Yeah, requiring an agricultural member.
Okay. So that part's been removed.
Right.
Thank you.
Actually, the bill is back closer to what it was originally. Yeah.
Right. Thank you.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, Katie, we'll call the roll.
Representative Estabrook.
Aye.
Representative Gilchrist.
Excuse, no, Representative Gilman just walked in.
Are you sure of that?
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye. Now you may want to rethink.
Representative Kiss.
Excuse.
Representative
Conklin. Aye.
Aye. Motion carried. We motion to put this on the consent calendar?
I'll make so moved.
Pardon? Representative Escalon moves we place 3257 as amended on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's on the consent calendar. Committee House Bill 2958 will be carried over to Friday's agenda. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3272. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3272 was a bill at the request of the American Council of Engineering Companies and the American Institute of Architects. The hearing was on April 8th. and it would have required local public contracting agencies to select an architectural, engineering, or land surveying service on the basis of qualifications, regardless of the size of the contract or financial participation by the state. It would have required QBS qualified based selection, with price being considered after the selection of the most qualified architect or engineering service for all contracts by local governments, including school districts, community colleges, cities, counties, and special districts. The amendments, the dash two amendments, replace the bill except for the part about the sunset clause. The sunset clause will be removed with the amendments. And instead of removing the thresholds altogether, as the original bill did, the dash two amendments would increase the threshold for the requirement of QBS from $400,000 projects to $900,000 projects, and would decrease the state funding level threshold, again, for requiring QBS to be that this from 35% to 10%. So a 10% state participation in a project would be the new threshold. Mr. Chair, there's representatives from the engineers here and representatives from some of the school districts, special districts, if you would want to ask them any questions.
John, could you come forward, please? John LaSalle. Marshall Koba.
Mr. Chair, this was a work group that you asked Representative Kitts to take care of, and that work group had two meetings between April 8th and today.
I assume that everyone's in agreement, huh? And David Barenberg, too. Any comments, Marshall?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Marshall Koba, representing the American Council of Engineering Companies of Oregon. We'd like to thank Representative Kitts and Janet Atkins for their assistance in the work group. The Dash 2 amendments are amendments that are supported by the engineers and by everybody that was in the room, including local governments, community colleges, and others. And just briefly, we would appreciate your support of the amendments and move the bill.
Chairman Brown, members of the committee, John O'Shell, Association of Oregon Counties. Speaking for the Association of Oregon Counties, we support the Dash 2 amendments.
Thank you, gentlemen. And David Barenberg indicate. David, would you come forward, please, and put it on the record, too?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is David Barenberg from the League of Oregon Cities. A old-time Eastern politician once said, in politics, if... you don't, it's better to say something than to write it, and it's better to nod if you don't have to say it. So in this case, Mr. Chair, I will nod.
Thank you, David. Thank you. I got one more question. I went fishing this weekend, and you told me one time what I washed my hands in to get that fish smell off. What was that?
Toothpaste. Mr.
Toothpaste.
Chair.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'll share that with my wife.
I get it.
The chair would entertain a motion to adopt the Dash 2.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Kitts.
More than happy to adopt those Dash 2s. If you just tell me what bill we're talking about.
3272.
I'd like to move Dash 2s into 3257.
3272.
3272, like I meant. I don't know what you heard, but what I said was move the Dash 2s into 3272.
Representative Kitts moves the Dash 2 to House Bill 3272. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they're adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kitts.
I'd move House Bill 3272 as amended to the floor, providing that's where it's going and not Ways and Means, with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3272 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Representative
Foley. Aye.
Representative
Pitt.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Motion carries. Would Representative Kitts... okay, Representative Kitts will carry the bill on the floor for us. Let's see. What am I down to, Janet? Most one. Schedule.
Yeah.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3092. And Janet, can you get us up to speed again, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was a hearing on this bill on April 13th. The bill is at the request of the Oregon Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors. And you have at your place today the dash two amendments, which replace the original bill. So I was going to just describe the dash two amendments. They would make review of plumbing system plans optional and allow state or local building codes agencies to review plans on request and to charge fees for the service. But again, the plan review would be optional. And there are a number of people to sign up to explain the bill. The original bill would have exempt complex structure plumbing system plans from plumbing specialty code review if the plan is designed by a professional engineer or registered architect. So those provisions are no longer in the bill, and again, it would just make plumbing review system plans optional.
Thank you, Janet. Can I have J.L. Wilson and Jared Broadfoot, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors for House Bill 3092. As you recall, in the original hearing, the plan review process was in part put in place for contractors so that contractors had an opportunity to work out the kinks in their plan up front so that it went into the field. It would be a streamlined process to get the job done without work stoppages. And as our prior testimony indicated, the customers are not happy with the system. There is a level of discontent when, in fact, time and money is spent on a plan review process only to have that plan review rendered meaningless in the field by a project being stopped because the project is not done according to the code, which was approved in the plan review process. So as you recall, in the original House Bill 3092, what we said is that if there was an architect or engineer stamp, which was according to the state plumbing code, you could bypass the plan review process, and then the job itself would be checked according to the approved plan or the stamped plan. We've scrapped all that and gone with a much cleaner, straightforward, and I'd consider market-oriented approach, and that is this. We make plan review optional. The plumbing contractors are the customers. If they feel that they are getting value for their dollar at the local level and at the plan review process, then they will utilize the plan review process that's offered by a local jurisdiction. If, in fact, they're having problems with the plan review process and it is not worth the time and money spent at the local level, then they will bypass it. And it's as simple as that. And from our point of view, it gets rid of the complexities of the original bill that dealt with architects and engineer stamps and the liability issues associated with that issue. That's removed from the table. You get rid of issues as to whether the inspection is done to the approved plan or whether it's done according to code. That's removed from the table. The bill simply proposes that if the plan review process is worth the time and money for the contractor, he will utilize it. If it is not, if there are problems, then he will bypass it. But the inspections stay the same. Everything else in the current system stays the same. I consider it to be a market-oriented approach that local governments can utilize and have incentive to put good plan review processes in place that are worth the time and money of a contractor. And that's what the Dash 2 amendments propose, and we are excited about those. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Jared?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Jared Broadfoot here today representing the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association in support of the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3092. As JL indicated, we want the best service that we can possibly get, and trust me, our contractors are not wanting to keep paying a fee for plan review if they're not getting a good service. We're still getting inspected in the field. The purpose of plan review is to ensure a streamlined process so we can get out, get work started, started on our jobs and not have an inspector come in and shut the job down, because we're building to a set of plans that we've already had approved through a plan review process that say we're building to code. So if we're not getting a good service through that, through plan review, then we obviously don't want it required. This makes sense. Having it optional, we're certainly going to use the service if it's a good one. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. I just have one question for both of you. It says here the department may provide the review and collect a fee. Now, you both are coming here telling me today that the industry is okay with this, correct?
Thank you, Chair Brown and Representative Schaffler. That is the current system. We're saying you can bypass the process or use the process as it currently is in place, and that's all this bill says.
Let me clarify, please, Mr. Chair. You're okay with the fee. That's the word I want to hear in this language.
Yes, the fee. Thank you, Chair Brown and Representative. The fee is already charged, right, and nothing changes.
Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate it.
Chair Brown, Representative Schaffler, we also do as well support the current system, which includes the current fee. So,
thank you very much.
Representative Escobar.
Yes. League of Oregon Cities, League of Oregon Cities opposed this as it was drafted last time. Were they on board with these drafts?
Thank you, Chair Brown and Representative Esquivel. I believe you'll probably hear from them later.
They are going to. The other thing is, you get into a situation where an architect or an engineer does the plans, it goes out, we're building away like crazy, and then we come to find out we have a whoops, and it is in need of red tag. Who's liable?
Thank you, Chair Brown and Representative Esquivel. That issue has been removed from the bill with the dash two amendments, because we no longer, as the original bill, require an engineer or architect stamp in order to bypass the plan review process. So that whole element has been removed from the bill in an effort to make it to increase just simplicity.
Any other questions? Representative Holman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow up on Representative Esquivel's question, I understand we've taken the engineer stamp, architect stamp, whatever away, which wasn't a real huge concern of mine, but I'm, you know, in reading this thing, I'm wondering who is liable if, in fact, because it looks like you're allowing a plumbing structure to be built out of compliance with the code. And if there's if that's not true, who is the contractor then liable for building to code still under this bill?
Thank you, Chair Brown and Representative Holvey. Under this bill, nothing changes. You either go through the current process, or if you're not getting value for the dollar, you can bypass it, and therefore all the liabilities that are in place today and with the associated parties remain the same. I don't see any change whatsoever in who is liable under any circumstance. You ask a contractor and they'll say, when's a local government ever assume liability for anything? So I don't think that the liability changes hands under any circumstance under this bill.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my point is, in this, is my question is the contractor going to be liable for building the plumbing structure to code to protect the consumer? I guess that's my question.
Thank you, Chair Brown and Representative Holvey. The simple answer is yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
No.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for your testimony. I'm not sure if I'm probably not pronouncing it. Cherise Kaler? Good morning. How close did I come?
Chair Brown, it's Charlesy Kaler.
Charlesy.
Since it's made up Southern, I'd listen to anything. Yeah. I answer to about anything.
So do we.
Good morning.
Chair Brown, representative members, I'm one of the owners, I'm Charles Kaler, as I said, and I'm one of the owners of Mortier Engineering of Eugene. Besides being an engineering firm, we offer code enforcement services to 14 jurisdictions in Oregon and a couple in Idaho. We've been in both businesses for over 73 years. And since we have a foot in two camps, we feel we have maybe a more balanced perspective. I got to confess, I love building codes. That's a little strange, but what I do appreciate is that it isn't arbitrary, and you can follow a line of logic as to why specific codes exist. Insurance companies and lenders insist that buildings be made safe for those who use it, and responsibly built to last for those who own it. The codes protect people and investments. Here's the plumbing code. That's just the plumbing code. Like most model codes, it's developed nationally by experts, including PHCC. With experience in all aspects of plumbing. And to become eligible to sit to test to become an inspector enforcing plumbing code requires thousands of hours of experience, usually in the trades and sometimes in combination as an inspector. Mm-hmm. Most jurisdictions require this as a minimum to check plans. Building Codes Division then requires these folks continue their education in order to stay abreast of changes in the code brought about by statistical information, empirical observation, and technical advancements. To the best of my knowledge, no such requirements are made of engineers, architects, or designers who have come to depend upon plans examiners as experts. They count on the extra set of eyes to check their work. I would ask that you flush this bill. This bill isn't just bad government, it's bad business. Plan checks are a small investment compared to the cost of the building, and unlike most investments, is rarely a risk. What we're talking about here, from the gentleman who preceded me, is a very rare instance of holding up construction because of an error in plans examination. Very rare. Most of the time, more than 90% of the time, I'm sure, probably closer to 99% of the time, it's an effective system. It works. Instead, a check minimizes risks by preventing long delays and longer bills when something's overlooked in the design process. If plans examination is made optional, builders would be tempted not to exercise the option, hoping to save time and money. Such a decision is penny wise and pound foolish. And I contend that the real customer here isn't the contractor, it's the building owner in the end. I'm sure those folks would appreciate the small investment of a plan check in terms of time and money. Either an amendment of this bill, or better yet, direct Building Codes Division to change the rule governing plumbing plan check. In electrical plans examination, certain things trigger. Certain levels of complexity and size trigger a plans examination. And if you don't want to require a plan check, at least have a level of complexity that would require one. Simple installations such as warehouses and offices probably wouldn't need something to that degree, and an option probably ought to be exercised. But larger projects, restaurants, schools, hospitals, care facilities, and other complex installations really must be checked. Lack of such oversight will sooner or later be noticed by ISO, which will in turn impact insurance costs in Oregon, and not for the better. Public safety and good business practice dictate responsible actions. Thank you for your time. Are there any questions?
Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you for your testimony this morning. Could I have Bill Cross, please? Not here. David Berenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dave Berenberg from the League of Oregon Cities. First, I'd like to thank J.L. Wilson for these amendments, which I think improve the bill in a particular respect, and then I'll express a few concerns. What this amendment does that was sorely missing from the original bill was it ensures that there is building inspection to code at the end of the day, and that is a real critical element that was missing from the bill as originally filed, that at the end of the day with the original bill, that a plan could be improved and inspections would be done to the plan regardless of whether it comported with building codes. So what this bill does is restores the sanctity of the final inspection process. that's a very important issue in protecting public health and safety. What this bill takes out of the process or makes optional is the plan review. And I think, as Mr. Wilson said, there was some concern in the on the building contractors end or the plumbing contractors end that there wasn't value added. And there should be value added, in, you know, for a step that government requires. The problem that still remains for local government, which is very difficult, is that now a complex project that has already been designed and constructed, in the process of being constructed, could have major violations of plumbing code, which then puts the local government inspector or the state inspector in the position of then saying, you have to rip out in a very costly way. The counter to that is, well, gee, if that happens one or two times, won't people see that maybe there's value to inspection or creating an incentive for local government to ensure that their inspections add value as a free market approach? I think that there is, you know, merit to that concept, but it still puts local government in a very difficult position, especially in complex projects of trying to have to rip out something that might have been designed, engineered, constructed, partially constructed, and then in ripping it out causing delays and much added expense, with government then becoming the villain. So where does that leave us, and what am I saying about the bill? I think the amendments are an improvement. I think that there are issues that still remain with the bill. Do I have any solutions to offer the committee at this point? No. I would like to and have our folks continue looking at that and work with JL as this moves through the process. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, David. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barenberg, let's put the customer, the contractor, the engineer all aside. When it comes right down to it, that's why we pay fees to government, to come out there and say yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
So I just don't have any sympathy. If this community wants building inspectors by the government, then that's exactly what they should do. We can call them villain. We can call them working in the good of the community, either way you look at it. So that's the job. That's the charge. And I don't know. I don't know what more to say about it. So I just wanted to make that comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you, David, for your testimony. Bill Cross, please.
Committee Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross, and I am here on behalf of the Oregon Building Officials Association. And my comments are very similar to Mr. Barenberg's. We have circulated the proposed amendments and have a number of jurisdictions that are still very uncomfortable with what will happen if we shift the plan review process to the field. And that's where changes will then have to be made during the inspection process, which will ultimately be more costly and time-consuming. So we're very concerned about that. We recognize that there is an issue with respect to inspectors checking plans or approved plans and indicating that there are violations outside of those approved plans, and that is an issue which we need to figure out a solution to, because the contractors are very frustrated, and I can certainly understand why. The bottom line is the jurisdictions will need a plan, whether it's reviewed or not, for purposes of looking at the SDC charges, for looking at sewer traps, other things that are outside the building code, plumbing code process. But the plan review can be a more cost-effective means of identifying potential code violations as opposed to doing it all in the field. So, much like Mr. Barenberg, we will continue to, we have a legislative committee meeting this Thursday, and hopefully we can maybe identify other options or approaches that we could suggest might, you know, deserve consideration by the contractors.
Thank you, Bill. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 3092? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3092 and open a work session on House Bill 3092. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 3092. I'm sorry, the dash twos?
Dash twos, right.
I move the dash twos into House Bill 3092.
Representative Kitts moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 3092. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they are adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kitts.
I move House Bill 3092 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3092 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know the dash two amendments have done quite a bit to quell my concerns with the inspection process. However, I still have a real concern about the integrity of the plumbing code being met and the protection of the public, and will be voting no on this bill. Thank you.
Representative Gilman.
Mr. Chair, committee, I'll be voting yes on this bill, because there's a definite problem that needs to be addressed. I'm not certain that this is the total answer yet.
And Representative Eskel.
I will be voting no on this because I think we owe the public more than this. I think if we want to get to the root of this whole problem, let's go back, recraft this bill, and have the cities and municipalities or jurisdictional organizations sign off on their plans. And if there's a change in the field between them and their own building code inspector, let the city be liable for it or the municipality. That's the way you clear up this problem.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll?
Representative Colby.
No.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
No.
Representative Eskelbaugh.
No.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Need a carrier on the floor?
I'm more than happy to. Bring it on.
Okay, Representative Kitts will carry it on the floor. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3093. Janet, please.
Chair. This is the first hearing on House Bill 3093. It was a bill at the request of the Oregon Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors also. And the original bill would transfer authority for certifying persons to inspect water system cross connections for persons to test backflow prevention devices from the Department of Human Services to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Under current law, the Department of Human Services has established a certification program for persons who inspect cross connections and who test backflow prevention device assemblies. The certification that comes with from DHS also requires the person to either become a licensed construction contractor or for certain irrigation systems to become a licensed landscape contractor. The certification obtained from DHS does not necessarily allow the person to install or to repair the connections and backflow devices they test. You have at your place the dash one amendments that are from the Independent Employer Association, and they would specify that a plumber's license is not required to repair water system cross connections or backflow devices. And the dash three amendments are from the sponsors of the bill, and they would specify that the Department of Human Services may not require a journeyman plumber or an apprentice plumber to obtain the DHS certification in order to inspect cross connections or test backflow assemblies. Both amendments would replace the original bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have J.L. Wilson, Ron Murray, and Jared Broadfoot, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, J.L. Wilson, representing PHCC, and I'll go first since our name happens to be on the bill. Just for the record, you know, we don't even support our own original bill. We just had that as a placeholder. What we're testifying in support of today is the Dash 3 amendments. Those are the only amendments to this bill that PHCC supports. The Dash 3 amendments simply say that the Department of Human Resources should not require, may not require, a certificate for competency under the backflow inspection program. Plumbers are already regulated by DCBS. This is an example of kind of releasing the stranglehold of government when it's not exactly necessary, so that plumbers don't have to obtain certification from the Department of Health and Human Services for the purposes of doing backflow when they're already regulated by DCBS. This is just something that's duplicative. It's well within their scope of abilities to be able to work on backflow devices. And so this is just an instance of being able to release them from certification from DHS.
Jared?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ron Murray. I represent the United Association of Plumbers and Steam Fitters of the United States and Canada. In the 2001 legislative session, working with Representative Schrader, who's now Senator Schrader, a task force was put together to take a look at the entire backflow program. And the reason that that was done was because the backflow program, quite frankly, is a disaster. Backflow devices are plumbing devices. By statute, they are defined as plumbing devices. By statute, they must be installed by a licensed plumber. And by statute, they must be installed under purvey of a plumbing permit. A licensed plumber undergoes, as I'm sure most of you are aware, 10,000 hours of experience and over 1,000 hours of didactic education to learn to install plumbing under the Uniform Plumbing Code, which is adopted in the state of Oregon. And as part of this, there's a very intensive section on backflow device testing and installation. As part of my testimony, I would like to also add that the Tri-County Water Association has come forward to accept the Dash 3 amendments, and the Tri-County Water Association, as well as the Water Legislative Subcommittee for the Special Districts Association of Oregon, has also been supportive of the Dash 3 amendments. The plumbing industry finds that there is no need for this outdated, superfluous fee, which, as you know, we pay as plumbers not only a plumbing license fee with Building Code Division, but we also pay this additional fee with the Health Division. And I'm going to give you an idea what we get with the Health Division. The Health Division, and it's no fault of their own, I'd say, I think they're wonderful people, but they have not provided oversight in any way, shape, or form of the backflow program. And this became very evident in the 2001 task force. Your water provider in your home district provides information and documentation to the Health Division, where it remains gathering cobwebs and boxes. It's not filed. It's not accessible. Last year, Dr. Higginson, the administrator of the Health Division, provided the industry with a letter that says in the entire history of the Oregon Health Division, they have filed one compliance case in their entire history for people that fraudulently worked on backflow devices. This was at the exact same time that we filed a complaint with the Building Codes Division, where they found an individual guilty on 43 counts of potentially violating the health and safety of the school children and the faculty at the Beaverton School District. And we succeeded on those charges, 43 counts, but the plumbing board had to do it. The Health Division didn't. The Health Division is going to testify that they could lose up to $9,000 in revenue if plumbers aren't licensed with the Health Division. And if $9,000 is the only problem that they have, they're in pretty doggone good shape. We believe that the licensed plumber obviously has the ability and the training to test the devices which only they are licensed to install. And we would like to see the economy of the state of Oregon further unstifled and streamlined by you moving forward on the Dash 3 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. Jared?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jared Broadfoot with the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. I here support the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3093 and only the Dash 3 amendments. As a side note, it's our understanding that the Dash 3 amendments would remove the fiscal impact of the original bill. So, okay. Just wanted to clarify that. It makes a lot of sense to adopt the Dash 3 amendments, and let me just boil it down for you. As both JL and Ron have outlined, if you're a licensed journeyman plumber or an apprentice, you're going through or have gone through the apprenticeship program where you have spent a considerable amount of time specifically on backflow devices. The plumbers that we represent know how to do this work, and it's another layer of red tape for them to have to go to the to DHS to get a certification that says they can do this work when their plumbing license already says that they're competent enough to do that work and a lot of other work on plumbing systems. So to keep it short and sweet, this amendment makes a lot of sense. The current requirement that they have to go to DHS makes absolutely no sense for licensed plumbers. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Could I have Grant Higginson, please? Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Chair Brown and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I am the administrator for the Office of Community Health and Health Planning in the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to, we're neutral on the bill, but I'm here today to raise some concerns that I think that you would like to hear about. As Mr. Murray just mentioned, five years ago, the backflow prevention program in the Department of Human Services was a troubled program, and we have been working over the last 3 or 4 years while I have been responsible for this program. I've been working with backflow testers, been working with plumbers, been working with water systems to try to improve this program. Some of the things that we've been trying to do are make sure that the program can be fiscally solvent so that we can provide the enforcement activities and other activities that people think are important. We also want to make sure that there is minimum standards for testers, whether they be plumbers or independent testers, and also we want to make sure that we develop a comprehensive unified program. And unfortunately, the Dash 3 amendments that are being discussed today, I think, have raised some concerns for me that it's actually going to be a detriment to the program. The first issue I wanted to talk about is fiscal solvency in the work that we have done with the industry. We developed new administrative rules that were put into effect over the interim, and what that did was created this cross-connection program that really is a comprehensive program that's providing all of the things that the industry and that we in government think are important. We feel that we do need to have a full-time employee in the position for the backflow prevention program, and unfortunately right now the certification fees only allow for about half-time person, which simply is not enough staff time to do the requirements of this work. Our concern is that even though it's a small loss in revenues from the plumbers who would no longer be certified through the Department of Human Services, that is a further stress on the fiscal resources of the program. The second issue that I wanted to address was certification standards. We strongly believe that everyone, whether they're a plumber or an independent tester, have certification so that we know that they are responsible and doing the work that they're being paid to do. My understanding, although Ron Murray said that all plumbers go through backflow prevention training, my understanding is that that is optional in the plumber's certification process. And as I say in my testimony, there could be a different way that plumbers get tested and certified, but I do think it's important that everyone go through a certification process so that we understand that they are indeed competent to be doing the work that they're being paid for. And then the final issue is I see that there is a potential for fragmentation. What we do is keep a list of all certified testers so that that list is available to the industry and to the general public. We also do enforcement, and Ms. Emery was correct that a couple years ago we had not had many enforcement activities. We have been much more active there in the last couple of years. So I have some concerns, though, about one, where does the public get comprehensive information if they're being certified one place and certified in another place at DHS? I also have some concerns about enforcement. Who is responsible for enforcement? Is it DCBS or is it the Department of Human Services? And how can we make sure that people are being treated equitably? So, in conclusion, we strongly believe that wherever the program resides, it needs to be fiscally solvent. There needs to be some minimum standards for certification that are applied equally, even if they may not be exactly the same testing. And then third, that it needs to be a unfragmented, comprehensive program. With that, I'll close and be happy to answer any questions.
Doctor, have you seen the amendments, both the dash ones and dash threes?
I have seen both amendments, yes, I have. And really, I'm only speaking to the dash three amendments at this time.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Holy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, I am looking at this and just thinking, you know, as long as we have building codes and they remain strong, it seems like the health and human services concerns are met in proper drafting and enforcement of building codes, and that our licensed plumbers are trained and educated in those codes and enforced by DCBS. And so this, your program seems like it's a duplication to me. Can you tell me how it's not?
Chair Brown, Representative Holvey, our program deals with the annual inspection of backflow devices to make sure that they are working appropriately and not allowing back siphonage or cross connection to contaminate potable water. So we actually don't have anything to do with the building's code side of it and them actually getting installed, but this program then is responsible for making sure that those devices are annually tested to make sure that they continue to function properly. And again, just to follow up, it would not have to be in the Department of Human Services, but what I'm saying, wherever it is, I think it needs to be a comprehensive, unfragmented program.
Thank you. Any other questions? I'm saying none. Thank you, Doctor. Mark Long, I got a question. Can you come up and answer? I don't know whether I'm asking the right person or not, but you're always willing to give me an answer.
I never shy of a word, Mr. Chair. Morning. For the record, Mark Long, Administrative Building Codes Division.
Plumber licensing, is that within your department?
Yes, sir.
Do they go through any training or certification for these backflow devices as part of their licensing procedure?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is part of the apprenticeship program that they receive some. Now, whether it's a direct requirement or not, I would need to check. Anecdotally, I've talked to the folks that are responsible, and they indicate that there is an amount of training that currently as an individual who starts off with, you know, no experience and goes through their 4 or 5 year program, they receive some classroom instruction on this. And we've also talked offline that we would be happy to look at that issue through our licensing standards and make sure it is indeed a requirement. I'd also like to just clarify, Mr. Chair, since I'm up here, this isn't about, from our perspective, where the program is or where it isn't. The question is what and how many different certifications or licenses do you need with the way the dash threes are written to test and inspect a particular backflow device. The dash threes suggest that a plumber who's gone through, again, 4 or 5 years of training is competent enough to test and inspect that backflow device under the current law. That's all the dash three does, says that our license that allows them to build from a simple water system to a hospital is competent to inspect and test the backflow device. So I hope I answered your question.
Thank you, Mark. Anyone else have a question, Mark? Representative Holdy.
One more. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Long, can you tell me a little bit about these annual inspections for the backflow devices? Is this a statute that's in plumbing code, or is this a statute that is that requires this annual inspection directly related to Health Department of Health and Human Services?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holden, I'm going to give you my best guess on this, and I think I'm accurate. The requirement of whether or not you need a backflow device for most purposes, and then the annual maintenance and testing occurs through the health division. Okay, we're simply talking about what level, and that doesn't change in the dash threes that I see it, or anything that I've read here this morning. What we're really talking about is, do they need the certification that health division issues, as well as the plumbing license that we issue, to perform that annual test, however and whenever it's prescribed by the health division currently. It's not anything that's under my requirements that I'm aware of, Representative Holby. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mark.
You bet.
Appreciate it. Ron, Murray, could you come back up? Maybe you can answer them. The question on training for the plumbers and their apprenticeship program.
Thank you, Chair. I have to reintroduce myself. I'm Ron Murray with the United Association of Plumbers and Steam Fitters. First of all, licensed plumbers are required when they pass their state test. Under the Uniform Plumbing Code, it addresses, there's a complete chapter in the Uniform Plumbing Code addressing backflow prevention devices. If you look at the current rules written by the Oregon Health Division, they actually refer to the Uniform Plumbing Code adopted by the state of Oregon, and there's a reciprocity between Building Code Division and the Health Division regarding the regulation of backflow devices. It is a requirement in our program that you be a licensed tester when you graduate from our apprenticeship program, absolutely. And if I may, on the annual testing, when we had the 2001 legislative task force, there's consideration giving on some of the systems to actually go to a three-year testing standards on residences or dwellings that aren't particularly hazardous, simply because it is so onerous on the property owner. That's not a rule, but it's in consideration, so it kind of gives you some idea where the task force was headed.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, sir.
One more question about the testing. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ron, whose responsibility is it to make sure these devices get tested? Is that the owner's responsibility, the DCBS, or the Health and Human Services, or the plumber who installed it?
Chair Brown, Representative Holvey, the Uniform Plumbing Code is very specific, and it states that the device must be tested immediately upon the installation. It doesn't specify who would do the testing. You only need to be a licensed tester to test the device. The responsibility of testing the device is on the property owner.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Ron.
Mr. Chairman, there's someone in the crowd. That's a good doctor is waving.
Again, for the record, Dr. Grant Higginson, Department of Human Services. And just on the responsibility issue, Chair Brown and Representative Holte, the water systems, the water purveyors are responsible for backflow prevention, for determining first who needs to have backflow prevention device, and then making sure that it's annually tested and providing results of those tests to us on an annual basis at the Department of Human Services. So the program itself is part of our overall drinking water program at the Department of Human Services, and that's why we think it's a public health issue. But like I say, the actual who needs a backflow prevention device and making sure it gets tested annually is the responsibility of the water system. And in those cases where the backflow device is on the personal property, then it is the owner who is responsible for making sure that that gets tested.
Thank you, Doctor. Now we're going to hear the other side of the story. Gover Simmons, Tom Hempel, and Roland Beebe, please. don't get to see one. Morning, Grover.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Grover Simmons. I represent the Independent Employer Association and the non-plumbers who actually do the physical work of repairing water cross connections and backflow prevention devices. We respectfully ask the committee to do three things. One, hold a bill, the printed bill, in committee. Secondly, adopt the -1 amendment to the printed bill. And thirdly, reject the -2 amendment and any other amendment which may have come to the attention of the committee after 4:30 on Friday, which means -3 at the current time. The rationale for our request is that the principal thrust of this legislation deals with a public health issue, not simply an issue of regulating some private business operation for economic reasons or to generate money for government purposes. The jurisdiction over this matter has been in the Department of Human Services for many, many years, and no compelling reason has been given for transferring it to another government agency. The Health Department is charged with assuring all Oregonians have safe drinking water and providing a simple, effective regulatory program for drinking water systems. While there has been testimony about the conduct of the Department of Human Services, I don't find it compelling, and I don't believe that the case has been made that the department has failed in its duty or failed the people of Oregon. So we believe the regulation of water should be left where it is. As to the issue of who can repair these cross-connection and backflow devices, the work is not extraordinarily complicated, so it can be performed by non-plumbers just as they have been doing for many, many years. But the situation does need clarification under the statute. When I went to the Legislative Council and explained what the goal was, that you don't need to be a licensed plumber to do this kind of work, and ask how to get this put into statutory language, the result was the -1 amendment. The amendment is clear and direct. It simply says nothing in the law prevents a person from repairing water system cross connections or backflow prevention devices. Over the weekend, I reviewed the history of the cross connection control program clear back into the 1960s, when the Portland Water Bureau experienced system contaminations after main breaks in the downtown distribution system. In the 1970s, the Safe Drinking Water Act was passed, and commercial testing and repair services became more prevalent. Then, as is the case today, the vast majority of assemblies were being tested and repaired by non-plumbers. In the 1980s, cross-connection programs for all public water systems became mandatory. In the 1990s, Measure 5, their budget cuts there severely affected the program, and Oregon water suppliers worked together to carry the certification program until the legislature adopted Senate Bill 782. In the 2000s, the Plumbers Union, Local 290, successfully held up the Department of Human Resources 2001 budget, forcing a confrontation between plumbers, the Plumbers Union, and the Health Division and the water suppliers. Senate Bill 343, sponsored by the union, attempted to move the program to building codes, but the attempt failed. Here in 2005, as in earlier years, the first effort, again, was to move the cross-connection program out of human resources and into the consumer and business services. Finally, the -2 amendment is simply to leave the program where it is, but have journeyman plumbers avoid paying any fee to human services for certification. In a budget session as tight as this one, with such severe shortages of money, the avoidance plan seems completely out of line and without merit. I urge the committee to adopt the -1 amendment to resolve a long-running test of wills between or within the Cross Connections program and bring some stability to an important health program. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Shoffley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Grover, it's been pointed out to me, and I'm not an expert on this, but I'm going to ask the awkward question, that by the contractors, both union and independent, and the union rep, that actually you do need to be a plumber, a licensed plumber, to inspect this. My question is, apparently there are non-licensed plumbers out doing this. Are they in violation of the statute while doing this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Schaffler, there are people in the room with approximately 100 years of experience of working with this, and could I defer to them for that answer? They can make their case because they are doing the work, they're repairing this, and they know the history better than I.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Let me go ahead with you then, sir. Thank you.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Hempel. I've been a certified tester for 15 years. I test approximately between 2,000 and 3,000 backflows a year, so I'm very aware of what's out there. I'm also aware of the problems that are out there. I also manufacture tools for repairing backflows. I'm the only one in the United States. I sell them all over the United States. I travel the United States. I talk to testers and water distribution people, plumbers, everywhere. Oregon is not unique in its problems in this field because it is fairly new, but we do have some definite problems. Number one thing that I've heard testimony on is that all plumbers know about backflows. That's false. I'm sorry. Most plumbers call us to repair them, and they stand there and watch. At the present time, if I have to repair one, I have to call a plumber out, and he stands there and watches me repair it, because they really don't know it. They don't go through the training. They don't know how to test. There are some out there that do, but they're very few and far between. They just don't have the training. And a plumber might see, as a rule, I'd say 10 to 20 backflows a year, where I see 2,000. You know, just from those numbers alone, you have a lot more experience dealing in what you're doing. When I got certified 15 years ago, I was told we could repair. And every time we go back for recertification, I was told we could repair, until a couple of years ago. And then they said, well, you can't repair. Somebody found something in the code book, says, well, you can't. Okay. I'm a licensed landscaper. I have a limited plumber's license, which allows me to install backflows. I can install irrigation systems, which means I cut into the main water line, install the backflow. And then they said first, well, you can't repair that. But now they've changed that and said, well, we can go ahead and repair that backflow that we can install, which makes sense. But I can't go in the building and repair that same backflow, which makes no sense at all. If I'm certified to do it outside, why can't I do it inside? The Plumbers Union also says that if you work for a city, you can repair a backflow with the same training I've had. What's the difference? Just because they work for a city and they're working on their own backflows, they can repair them. Again, there's no competency differential there. As opposed to your question, are someone repairing a backflow now? Yes, there probably are some people that are still doing it, because this has just happened within the past couple of years. And there are some very people that don't know. It's taken some time to get it out there. But those of us that are involved in it do not do it anymore unless, like I said, I'll call a plumber and have them stand there. But then I have to charge the customer more. In Illinois, in my travels, Illinois, you have to be a licensed plumber to test or to repair a backflow. The standard fees are between $65 and $85 for a homeowner. In Oregon here, I get $25. In a business, for that same one-inch device, it's $300 to $350. again, I get $25. By pushing this to the plumbers union, a plumber makes almost $80 an hour. Most plumbers that I talk to don't even want to mess with these. Why would, if you're making $80 an hour, why do you want to go drive somewhere and test something for $25? It doesn't make sense. 90 to 95% of the devices I go out on, I'll go out, it's been replaced rather than repaired. And I said, well, what happened to your old device? Well, it was leaking, so a plumber came out and just repaired it. They don't know how to repair, most of them, so they just replace it. You repair a 2-inch device, it's under $100. You replace it, you're looking at $600 to $700. So how are we doing the business community a service or the public a service by pushing this into an area that just raises the fees and makes them madder, and then they're not happy, and they try and do everything they can do to get out of the testing? And fact is, there are a lot of backflow incidents. When I got certified, I had a book about an inch thick that they gave me of backflow incidents, and most of them were in this area. They happen all the time. Most of them we never hear about. But your drinking water is very, very important. I mean, we live a luxury here in this country. We can turn on our tap and drink the water and not have to worry about it. You can't do it in Mexico, and you can't do it in a lot of most other countries. And there's a reason for that, because we protect it. If we eliminate this and try and put this program into position to where we're not taking care of it and people are balking at it with high fees, there's no way that we're going to protect our drinking water. Do you have any questions?
Where's this device located at in your line? Up with a meter or on your house or where?
They can be anywhere. On an irrigation system, usually they're either right by the meter or they're at the closer to the house somewhere. You cut into the main line and run a main line off of that for the irrigation system.
How do I know if this thing fails?
You don't. That's why we test them yearly. And I did bring one. I forgot about that sitting right here in front of me. Just this is a very simple device. This is what we use on our irrigation system. It's a double-check device. There are two checks in here. There's two for the reason if one fails, there is a second one. And for both of them to go bad at one time is very rare. It does happen. The system inside here is really very simple. The cap comes off. You have a spring, a plunger, and a washer that sits against a seat. So to repair most of these devices, all it encompasses is taking the cap off, replacing a washer. 90% of the times, that's it, and putting it back together. You flush it, make sure there's no dirt in the line, nothing in there, and stick it back together. It's not a very complicated issue. The RP devices get a little more complicated knowing what they're doing. And there are about, I don't know, probably 200 different devices out there. So they're slightly different things for each. I make 26 different tools for taking them apart, so there's quite a few different ones. And the knowledge of how they work and getting used to certain devices, excuse me, have different rubber compositions, so they, in different areas, the washers go bad differently. They get black and gucky, and you take them apart, and they're really ugly looking. That kind of thing only happens with experience in doing it. You can't do it by taking them out and throwing them away and knowing what's there.
Representative Sean.
Thank you. And, sir, I appreciate your candor. I really do. That's something that I don't think we have enough in this building. And I know we have an encyclopedia of statute. It all needs clarification, not just this area here, I'm sure. But I will tell you, it's much more of a statement than anything else, other than my statement of appreciation for your candor and honesty. I do want real bright, clear lines between a landscaper, with all due respect to you, sir, and a licensed plumber. One works on my yard, an irrigation system. The other one works on my house. And I that's all I really wanted to say, but I appreciate your honesty and candor. Thank you.
Can I reply to that, sir?
Absolutely.
In that I do have that limited plumber's license, which means I had to take a test, and I had to pass that test in order to receive that. every landscaper cannot install backflows.
That's right.
It's a limited amount of them that can do it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hempel. Mr. Beebe, you'd like to give your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chairman Brown and Chair People. My name is Roland Beebe. I am with Northwest Backflow Inspection and Testing. I'm the owner and the tester of that company. Been in business for 4 years. I bought the business prior from the owner that had established it in 1989. In a year's time, I'm testing 3,000-plus backflow assemblies. These can vary anywhere from assemblies, irrigation, to pop dispensing machines in restaurants, to fire systems in large high-rise structures throughout the Portland metro area. To that effect, I am certified by the state. I have to go through recertification every 2 years and pay my contractor's fees and hold liabilities and certification for backflow testing. I am here basically in opposition to the House bill and feel that the state of Oregon's health department has and is doing a good job of maintaining certification, and they have here in the last few years gone through an extensive reevaluation of the program, got the input from a large number of people to determine what was best for the enterprise of backflow testing here in the state of Oregon. And to that effect, I feel that they've done a good job, and we basically work under their jurisdiction and provide the backflow testing that the community of, and the state of Oregon requests. To that end, I will turn it back, and if you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Beebe. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. We have Jim Olbrich, David McDonald, please.
Thank you.
What to do now? Flip a coin. Whichever one wants to start first, I'll go right ahead.
Representative Brown, Chairman Brown, Representative. My name is Jim Olbrich. I'm with Columbia Cross Connection, a small testing company in the Portland area. And I've got an extensive background in the backflow industry. I started out in 1977 with the City of Forest Grove as an engineer. The community development department and ran the backflow program there for about 15 years. Wrote the ordinance, city ordinance for the city of Forest Grove. Basically started my business in 1992 and have been testing 5,000 devices a year since. The program basically, I support the Dash 1 amendment and strongly oppose the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendment. Just a follow-up to what Roland and Tom Hempel said, that the industry right now currently is the testers have been pretty much doing the lion's share of the testing for years, probably 25, 30 years, and plumbers as well have been doing the same, but mainly the independent testers. Currently, probably a few times a week, I'll get calls from plumbing companies that are requesting that I assist them or help them out with a device that they have that's failing, when from what we're hearing from the other side, they should have the arm to be able to do that themselves. So, again, I just feel that it's trying to take a wrong step to change it.
Thank you, Jim. David?
Hello, thank you. My name is Dave McDonald. I'm an employee of a public water utility, have been for over 20 years. I've been closely involved with Cross Connection Control for the last dozen years or so. I also am a member of the Oregon Cross Connection Specialist Regional Subcommittee, which basically is a group of cross connection control specialists from various utilities around the state, and we gather, we network quarterly, and support one another and stay abreast of current issues and whatnot. And I came here today with the intention of speaking towards the original bill. I didn't know anything about any of the amendments until I got here today. But as what I handed out to you, a couple things I wanted to speak to. First of all, most basic, if something isn't broken, I don't see why we're fixing it. As you've heard here earlier, we've just recently completed quite an extensive process of rewriting the administrative rules that govern our programs. And to adopt 3093 would be quite a shift from that, and that seems illogical to me. I don't think there's, in my opinion, there's not a demonstrated need to do this. The OARs, they mandate that we utilities run these cross-connection programs. They mandate that we have certified inspectors on staff. When somebody has a problem with water quality in the middle of the night, a broken main or dirty water, it isn't a building official they call, it isn't a plumbing inspector they call. It's the water utility. We ultimately are responsible for the quality of the water we distribute to our citizens. And as part of that, it doesn't make any sense to pull us out of the loop when it comes to exerting some influence in the testing and inspection of backflow testers. Backflow testing and having backflow assemblies, it's all in the name of preserving the integrity of public drinking water, which we are responsible for underneath human services. It just makes no sense to reduce our level of influence, frankly, on this area of, you know, public health. Another thing I want to add is that by all indications, federal EPA is going to be mandating cross-connection control regulations on all of us in the not-too-distant future. And as a primacy state in Oregon, it'll come under human services. And again, it makes no sense to move something that's going to be coming down the pike, to move it out of the very agency that'll be expected to enforce it. So for those reasons, and probably others as well, I'm opposed to this, and I would hope that with, you know, cross-connection control inspection and backflow testing, the certification for which would stay under the auspices of human services.
Representative Shumpert.
Thank you. This is a technical question. I have my meter and I have a pressure valve that I can reduce or increase the water pressure that comes out off the main line. Is there, if I don't have an irrigation system or anything like that, in my meter, is there a backflow valve already there?
No, there's not.
Okay.
Not an approved backflow assembly.
Well, and I might add to that, there might be. it could vary from utility to utility.
Right.
Different utilities choose to protect their systems in ways different than a neighboring one might. Generally speaking, it's
very rare.
Okay. It is better. Very rare, but there are
some agencies will piggyback. They'll require that the meter be installed with a device piggyback onto it. But I think I only know of one that's doing it right now.
So it's not you.
Briefly, Mr. Chair. Now, a new construction, are we requiring? I just replumbed my house and I got a permit. I'm according to Hoyle, and
I
didn't see what there in my meter. It's just an old-fashioned.
Well, again,
meter.
Not under the OAR minimums, but again, a local utility could choose to go above and beyond that and make a point there.
My question is: in new construction in Happy Valley, for example, are they installing backflows?
Is that part of Sunrise Water District?
Yeah,
they were talking about it a couple years ago. I'm not sure if they initiated that or not.
Right. I believe in that particular district.
They may be. Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm on the budget committee, and we're meeting tomorrow night, and by God, I'll find out.
Yeah.
let me emphasize, if that is one of the districts, it's an exception. It's not universal across the state,
right.
But there are some who are doing it that way.
All right, thank you.
Any questions? Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me when utilities are working on the water system that they own and whatnot? Do their installations fall under DCBS inspections?
I'm not sure if I understand you totally. When you say we and
as a utility, you're installing a utility-owned water line.
Okay.
Do you fall under plumbing code enforced by DCBS?
As I'm probably not the best authority for that question, but as I understand it, our work out in the public right-of-way, no. As I understand the plumbing code, it has to do with private property plumbing installation. So, no, as if you're talking about our meters and our mains out in the street, out in the public right-of-way, I believe not.
Thank you.
And so, did you gentlemen testify you support the dash ones?
I
testified in support of dash one and opposed dash two and dash three.
As I understand it, having just heard it today on a crucial level, I think I probably would support one and not two and three, but frankly, again, just heard about it today, haven't really read it with any great, you know, detail, in any great detail. Right?
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it. Steve?
Is that?
Yep, that's it. Steve West and Mike Brimmeister. Did I get somewhat close?
Briesmeister. You're
Briesmeister. Okay. Why don't we start with you then, Steve, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Stephen West, supervisor with the Eugene Water and Electric Board and a former chair of the Oregon Cross Connection Inspectors Regional Subcommittee. I've provided you with copies of my testimony, so I'll keep my comments brief. First, I'd like to say that the program is very important. It's an important public health measure. In my 20-odd years involved in the Cross Connection program in Eugene, I've seen a major food processing facility contaminate their plumbing system with antifreeze, a lumber products mill contaminate their plumbing with a fungicide and a stain treatment. In both those cases, those contaminations were prevented from reaching the public water system because the utility had required a backflow prevention device and overseen the annual testing of that assembly. If Ray Johnson or Pat Dorning with the City of Redmond were here today, they could tell you a story about 1989 when they sent 8 teachers to the hospital at the Redmond High School because they contaminated their drinking water supply with antifreeze from a cooling system, an air conditioning system. The bill, 3093, is identical to the SB 343 from the 03 session. That bill was worked extensively and nearly made it to the floor for a vote. We knew there would be a follow-up bill introduced this session, and we hoped it would be in the final version of SB 343. I would ask you to consider amendments to 3093 that would capture the consensus that was formed around SB 343 in the 03 session, retain the program in Department of Health Services, and create dedicated funding for the program. We've heard how this program is problematic. Well, I've been around as long as anybody. I think I could safely say I know as much about this program as anybody. I've, in fact, included my phone number there on the hearing sheet, so I would entertain any questions that you have either today or afterward. But the program has been quite successful. In my experience, very successful. Like all programs, it's had its ups and downs, and certainly after the cuts from in 91 and Measure 5 cuts and then Measure 47 cuts, we've seen some difficult times. Since the 03 session, the program rules have been updated with broad support from all parties involved. Department of Health Services has just constituted an advisory board as set forth in those rules to help ensure ongoing and open dialogue in the program. Again, the program has been very successful. It's recognized across the nation. I would ask that you please continue that success. Help us finish the work that we began in the 03 session with a bill that models the consensus of SB 343, and with that, I would entertain any questions that you have.
Any questions? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Chair Brown. Thanks for your testimony. It's very helpful, but, you know, I'm just looking at this, and I understand, you know, the Department of Health's interest in making sure our water is safe, and I support that. But in fact, it seems to me that, you know, they test the water, and when it comes down to the plumbing parts or the piping parts or whatever, we have a plumbing code that's been developed specifically for installation and materials
that are designed to protect health, basically, in our water systems. And, you know, I'm looking at this and seeing two agencies lapping over and sort of doing a lot of the same thing, and it seems like it's a duplicated process to me. And so, you know, and that was why I asked about the utilities' involvement on their own stuff. I agree with you that the program's important, but I'm just looking at it from a jurisdictional point of view that, you know, the plumbing piece of it and the infrastructure of plumbing, you know, is built according to codes which are designed to protect the water quality or this, you know, sewage or whatever, the safety. And it seems to me that that purview belongs in plumbing codes and Department of Consumer and Business Services. The actual water quality, then, you know, the testing of the water itself, which the utility would be involved in with the Department of Human Services, something a little bit separate than these backflow devices specifically. Can you comment on that for me?
Chairman Brown, Representative Hovey, there's a missing piece in what you just described. And certainly the plumbing code is there to provide the kinds of protections that the cross-connection program provides. But it is a code in time. If I want to build a structure, then I go through the plans review process, obtain my permits, install that structure. Once that's done, the plumbers are gone, the inspectors are gone. The water purveyor becomes responsible for monitoring the water quality and ensuring protection of that water quality forever. And it's that piece in between. What happens after the system's been approved and installed that this program provides protection for? The two cases that I gave were both facilities that were inspected, installed, all correct at the time they were done, but systems that had been added, processes that had been added, changes that had been made along the way created these possibilities for contamination. I know of not one jurisdiction in the state where the building department or the plumbers or anyone else is providing ongoing protection of that water quality other than the water purveyor. And that's why this program was created back in the 60s, when the program got underway in Oregon in 1974, after the Safe Drinking Water Act was passed, federal legislation, the program activities were stepped up, and then in 1981, when the Oregon Drinking Water Quality Act was passed, it became part of the Oregon revised statutes. Oregon administrative rules outlined this as a specific program and a requirement for all public water systems in the state of Oregon.
I don't dare follow that up.
Any other questions? Mike, why don't you give your testimony, please?
Okay, I'm Mike Briesmeister. I'm here today as a testimony, Chairman Brown and the representatives. As you can see in my testimony in front of you, I had not seen the amendments until I arrived here this morning. So my testimony is going to be in regards to what the original was as far as moving it into consumer business services, and I'm opposed to that. I also have with me some other letters from other testers down in Eugene area, approximately four or five, that are like mine. I'd like to speak real quickly in regards to the number three amendment. I am opposed to it. As it stands right now, the cross-connection program in Oregon is, across the nation, is looked at as one of the best. Okay? The people, USC, has an engineering school down there, and which are the people that basically approve assemblies, okay? They look at Oregon and they say, you're one of the few that are on the par level with us. So Oregon is looked at as the cream of the crop. And it's happened over the last 20, 30 years. It's an evolved process. It has gotten better and better and better to this level where it's a very well-respected program. And to all of a sudden exclude one group of people from meeting that standard, which everybody else has, all the other testers, is not a good way to go. Testers in the state should be all considered the same quality. And if you deviate from that standard, then we're going to start having differences in, you know, testers and the service that they provide. So I'm opposed to 2 and 3.
Thank you, Mike. Any questions?
Just a statement. I don't really see this as deviating from the standard so much, or you know, the requirements is for me. It seems like we're trying to consolidate the licensing and the standard, you know, in one agency and not in two. I just don't see how having DCBS administer the licensing and the actual construction of the plumbing infrastructure, you know, reduces the standard at all. I think the program's really important. I just question, I guess, why we have the Department of Health and Human Services and DCBS both regulating the same thing.
Well, again, you know, I think it's very important that, as Steve had mentioned earlier, that, you know, the building codes is in there when that permit is taken out and when that building is built. And then they're gone, okay? At that point, it becomes the water purveyor's responsibility to protect the water system. And that's what we're doing. The other organization is gone.
Chairman Brown, Representative Holt, could I make a response to that as well? The Building Codes Agency does not provide tester certification. There is no program set up other than Department of Health Services program. There are multiple plumbing apprenticeship programs scattered around the state. So I think to suggest that there is... So I don't see anything in Dash 3 that would provide for a state certification for licensed plumbers universally. It just says if you've got a license, then you're certified to test and repair. Doesn't specify a training regime. Doesn't specify any formal certification.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony.
Thank you.
One more time. Mark, could I, Mark Long, could, and Dr. Higginson, could I have you come up to again, please?
Dr. Long.
Dr. Long.
Good morning again.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your patience with us. Representative Software.
Mr. Chair. I want to make this. It would just make sense to me that the building codes would inspect the actual plumbing, whether it's installation or the monitoring of it, and that the health department would inspect the quality of the water. Now, that's a layman's perspective, but it just makes sense to me. But I think we've kind of went astray here. So what I'd like is you guys to kind of clarify what this bill does, because I think we have really ran afield here.
Mr. Chair, Mark Long, I don't mind going first with building codes. First, I think it's important to understand that the whole issues about where the program resides, transferring the program, the health division, all that, was essentially walked away from in the Dash 1 and Dash 3 amendments. There's none of that's on the table. And as far as I know and from what I hear, the health division does a stand-up job in what they do and trying to administer the things that they're responsible for. This bill in no way, neither the Dash 1 or the Dash 3, have anything to do with the frequency and whether or not you need backflow and the annual testing or any of those kinds of issues. You're doing that, and you're doing a fine job, and that continues on. What you have is, and I'm just a bureaucrat, but it looks pretty simple to me, what you have in the Dash 3 amendments, the question before you is, for the purpose of inspecting when one's installed, and on the annual basis that it is required to be inspected, for the inspecting and testing of that device, do you need to have a plumber's license from me as well as a certificate from the health division? That's the issue with Dash 3. Dash 3 says you don't. Okay?
You've heard a lot of testimony about concerns back and forth. I can't tell you all the technical issues. I can just give you something very quick. If I've got problems with plumbers not knowing what they're doing with drinking water systems, regardless of backflow, I've got bigger problems, because with their license, they get to do a whole bunch of things in this state, frankly, that are as complex, if not more complex, than backflow devices. So that's dash three. Okay? The question is whether or not to inspect and test under the existing authority, do you need to have a license from me and a certification from Grant? With dash one, that is a different issue, and that is simply about repair. And that is, do you need to have a plumber's license to repair backflow devices? Not test, not install, repair. Current law suggests that you do. Dash ones say that you don't. It exempts the license that I issue from repair. So two different amendments. They completely gut and stuff the bill. The issues are not whether the program's working fine or not. As far as I know, it's working fine. They're doing a bang up job. They've gone through interim work. They're on top of their issues. It's not about transferring it to building codes or DCBS. It's about whether or not you need a plumber's license and a certificate to inspect and test. It's dash three. Dash one is whether or not you want to exempt people from a plumber's license to do repair work. That's what's on the table. And if I've missed this, I'm fairly simple in the way I look at things. Please correct me.
Great. No, Chair Brown, members of the committee, I think that Mark is absolutely right on here. And my understanding, too, is that the original bill is off the table now, moving it to DCBS.
All those things you heard are really not relevant, frankly.
The dash one amendments, to me, really seems like a scope of practice issue, and it's one that I'm not going to get into, and will remain neutral on that. And as Mark said, the issue in the dash three is, to me, is does the training that a plumber gets at the time they become a plumber then qualify them to do backflow device testing for the rest of their career? And I am confident that the annual, that the certification that we do with inspectors or plumbers, and the annual requirements for training and education and hands-on testing is making sure that those people are qualified in the work that they do. I cannot speak to whether or not the training, and I don't know if there's any continual education training for plumbers, actually meets those qualifications. You know, one thing I can say is that, you know, many years ago I went through medical school, and I'm licensed in the state of Oregon to be a physician and surgeon. And while I did some surgery, you know, back during my training, I'm board certified in public health and am not qualified to be a surgeon because I just happen to have that certification. And just one other thing that I wanted to mention is just in the scope of the program, we believe about 20% of the testers, the certified testers, are plumbers, but we don't have that firm number because that's not something we routinely collect.
Doctor, could you tell us how big is the budget for administering this program?
Right now, the total budget's a little over $100,000. And as I mentioned, $100,000, that's per biennium. We basically have one full-time FTE right now. But as I mentioned, there are some real fiscal problems with the program. We have one-time funding to cover this biennium, but really we only have half-time funding with those certification fees for next biennium.
Thank you, Dr. Representative Shaw.
Thank you. And Mr. Long, just to clarify this for me, we're not establishing any new fees, raising any fees. Correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Officer, absolutely not.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Matter of fact, Mr. Chair, just to help Grant with his program, if you pass dash threes, I suspect that's somewhat of a revenue reduction to your organization. Is that correct? But from the contractor's perspective, that's a quote-unquote fee reduction to them because they're paying in two organizations. So none of us are adjusting our fees within our organization.
Jen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was some testimony that the testers were allowed to repair up until a couple of years ago, and then a determination was made. So were they legally and qualified to do that at that time or not? Up until a couple of
Mr.
years
Chair,
ago.
Mr. Chair, Senator Janet? You know, I'm just going to just, again, be quite simple. I'm going to assume that because the proponents of Dash 1 want to clarify that repair isn't required under the law, that it is required under the current law. And my guess is you've heard half hour, hour of testimony. This issue is fairly confusing. I suspect the level of enforcement out there, whenever you have something that's confusing, the level of enforcement, the level of information, you know, confusing, level of information enforcement goes down. You can just see it on a curve. And I suspect that up until a few years ago, folks didn't have a very good understanding of what the law was. But the way I'm reading this, that's presented in front of me, and it's just sitting here in the committee room, if we're asking for an exemption for repair, that tells me currently it's required to have the license. So, I answer your question?
Any other questions?
I don't know what ended the repair.
No, I would just agree with Mark, Chair Brown, that I believe this issue has been one that's had some confusion around it and predates my involvement in the program. And I think at one time the public health agency did give out some misinformation that it was okay to do repairs. And in the work that we've done over the last couple of years, it's become clear that that is not the case.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
Yes.
And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3093 and open a work session on House Bill 3093. Committee, what's your...
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kitts.
I'd move the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 3093.
Representative Kitts moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3093. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the Dash 3 are adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kitts.
I'd move House Bill 3093 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means.
We have a letter to rescind, right?
Mr. Chair, we do not have a fiscal impact statement from Legislative Fiscal Office. The bill does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee, and Dr. Higginson explained the fiscal effect of, I think it's $9,000 annually on a $100,000 biennial budget, so $18,000 biennial amount. We don't have a legislative fiscal statement. The sponsor did request from pre-approval from the Speaker's office. If the committee decided to rescind the referral, the Speaker would take that under consideration. So,
is that the desire of the Chair, to rescind the referral to Ways and Means?
Yes.
Then, Mr. Chair, I would move that we rescind the referral to Ways and Means and move this bill directly to the floor.
Representative Kitts moves that we rescind the referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The referral has been rescinded.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kitts.
I'd move House Bill 3093 as amended to the floor if you do pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3093 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Chopper.
Aye.
Representative
Kitts. Aye.
Representative
Bestman.
Aye.
Representative
Gilman. No.
Representative Foley.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, may I ask that we suspend the rules to allow Representative Kitts to vote on House Bill 3257?
First, we need a...
forgive me. I'll volunteer for that,
too. Okay. Representative Schaffler will carry this bill on the floor for us. And, Representative Schaffler moves that the rules be suspended to allow Representative Kitts to vote on which bill?
3257.
3257. Is there any objection? Seeing none, Representative Kitts, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Kitts votes aye on House Bill 3257.
I'm the only aye?
Do you have any objection to it being placed on the consent calendar?
I do not.
Okay.
Oh, good.
Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill, is that 2404?
Mm-hmm.
On, Janet, please give us a rundown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2404 was sponsored by this committee at the beginning of the session. You don't need to pay attention to the original bill. The amendments are a gut and stuff, and you have the dash one amendments at your place. You can also ignore most of those pages and just turn to page five of the amendments, and that's where the change is. Dash one amendments would specify that this is, we're into workers' compensation now. We're out of plumbing and into workers' compensation.
That just switch gears pretty fast.
Wow. The amendments on page five specify that penalties will not be assessed for a reconsidered claim award resulting from circumstances that are beyond the control of the insurer or self-insured employer. Mr. Chair, if there are findings of certain things under workers' compensation, workers' compensation owes the claimant, but also would be required to pay penalty fee beyond what's the payment required to the claimant. And this bill would clarify another circumstance when that penalty wouldn't be assessed. The pay to the claimant would still be required, but the penalty would not be assessed if the findings were that there were the circumstances were beyond the control of the insurer or a self-insured employee. Mr. Chair, it's my understanding this has been conceptually through MLAC. The MLAC has not seen the final wording of the amendment, but that's the case that it stands.
Okay, thank you, Janet. Sean Miller and Vicki Graves, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller representing Liberty Northwest. Before you, as Janet indicated, is the dash one amendment. That is the gut and stuff. Don't be alarmed of the 20-page amendment. Literally, the language on lines four and five of the bill, or the dash one amendment on page five, was the language that reflects the MLAC conceptual approval of last Thursday. This was an issue, and I have Vicki Graves with me, the manager of the claim closure unit, who brought this issue before the Management Labor Advisory Committee and also brought this language to the Trial Lawyers Association of some unintended consequences when this language was initially created. Since Thursday, the language that we brought forth, we've worked with the division with the language that you see before you that, again, we believe reflects that conceptual approval. And I know J.L. Wilson is also here who chairs that, the Management Labor Advisory Committee. But at this point, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just turn over to Vicki to talk about the specific examples and why this is a simple fix to this particular problem. Thank you.
Morning, Vicki.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Vicki Graves. I'm the manager of the claim closure unit at Liberty Northwest. I'm testifying today on behalf of Liberty Northwest and in support of amendments to 656-268-5E that would limit imposition of penalties when permanent disability awards are increased as a result of a request for reconsideration to those situations in which the increase in an award is attributable to the acts or failure to act of a self-insured employer or insurer. Existing language is sufficiently broad that it also mandates a penalty under some circumstances in which a self-insured employer or insurer has acted lawfully and appropriately in rating impairment, only to see the award increase based upon changes in an opinion of an attending physician or other factors that are not within its control. While a penalty provision that sanctions the breach of a duty by an insurer or self-insured employer makes sense, it makes no sense to penalize an insurer or self-insured employer for matters over which it had no control. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have a couple of examples. I'll provide one and then a little bit more detailed and then two very brief examples. In one example, the insurer issued a closure based on information provided or and approved by the attending physician. The notice of closure issued awarding a Class 1 impairment. During the reconsideration process, the attending physician informed the appellate review unit that the worker actually had Class 2 impairment. The order on reconsideration awarded Class 2 impairment and assessed a penalty under 656-268-5E. Following a hearing, the penalty was upheld as it was mandated by statute. In two other examples, we had situations where the insurer was penalized following an order on reconsideration when information regarding a worker's return to work status had changed between the time the closure was issued and the reconsideration was issued. In another example, a worker was released to regular work at time of closure. Following the closure and before the reconsideration order was issued, the work status changed and a penalty was issued against the insurer. Another potential situation is a circumstance when a worker is under the age of 40 at time of closure and before the order on reconsideration, they turn 40. In those circumstances, under the current statute, a penalty would be assessed against the insurer. The proposed amendment would limit penalties under 656-2685E to those situations in which the insurer or self-insured employer has either made an error in rating impairment or has failed to meet its obligation to obtain full information necessary to rate the worker's impairment. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
And so what this has to do with is the insurer being penalized for something, a decision that was made that they actually had very little or no control over.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. And again, we are not changing the statute when it is our particular fault, and these are beyond situations beyond our control. And I think that was the intent when MLAC heard that, when they've heard these circumstances and said, yeah, we would obviously conceptually approve this particular language.
Yeah, I request that MLAC does come up and confer that. And the second thing, give me a layman's example. Take all that legalese out and give me an example of how what this means. I want, you know, somebody breaks their leg and they turn 40, something like that. Give me just a real simple language example of what we're talking about here.
A case example?
Anything. You can make one up.
Of an example of when we would not be penalized or
yes.
When we would.
When this language applies is what he's asking.
The new language.
Exactly.
Would
that's
apply.
Exactly what I'd like to hear. Simple layman's
okay.
Example.
Well, using the examples that, a couple of the examples here, I'll use the example of the change in work status. At the time of closure, a worker is released to regular work, and we issue the closure, and at that point in time, certain benefits are not allowed to the worker because they have been released to regular work. They wouldn't get certain impairment benefits. After the claim closure, the doctor would change the work restriction and add work restrictions, maybe saying that they could not lift 100 pounds, and before they could lift up to 100 pounds, and they were within their regular job.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Between closure and the time that the decision's made, something happened.
Yes.
To make that person incapable of lifting 100 pounds.
Yeah.
And the initial case has nothing to do with that. And the initial assessment would be for that going backwards, not going forwards. But then they'd probably come in and ask for something for why they couldn't lift 100 pounds. But okay, I think I got it squared away, Mr. Chair. Sean, you said the Oregon Traveler Association had some concerns originally.
Mm-hmm.
Do they still express any concerns regarding this language?
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kitts. My understanding is there's no opposition to the amendment. Our original draft tried to create a standard of errors and omissions for the insurer. They thought that standard was a little ambiguous, and so when we addressed this at the Management Labor Advisory Committee, they came up with this particular language again, and there's, to my knowledge, no opposition. They were fine conceptually with our conversation.
Thanks, Sean.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you. Excuse me.
No, Mr. Chair, I'd just like the representatives from MLEC to come up here and
yes.
Say that they're happy.
Yeah, we intend to.
Or not.
Thank you, Chair Brown, and members. For the record, J.L. Wilson, co-chair of the Management Labor Advisory Committee. We saw this bill before us at our last Thursday hearing. Both management and labor was unanimously persuaded that circumstances do on occasion change, and sometimes insurers are unfairly penalized for things that they just have no bearing over. So we unanimously approved the bill. And furthermore, we approved it in concept. These aren't things we tend to micromanage. I don't need to see language again unless there's some glaring problem that boils to the surface. So from our perspective, it's just fine.
Thank you, JL. Appreciate it. Any other Anyone else that testify on House Bill 2404? Okay. All right. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2404. Open the work session on House Bill 2404.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kitts.
I'd move the dash one amendments into House Bill 2404.
Representative Kitts moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2404. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they're adopted. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move House Bill 2404 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2404 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye, excuse.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kitts.
I'd move 2404 be placed in the consent calendar.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2404 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none. It's done. And with that, we are adjourned.